From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from the festively decorated Argo Studios in New York City. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it. Do it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you made a donation this week, I really want to say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Happy Thanksgiving. As we share some of our favorite conversations from past editions of State of Belief Radio, please don't think of them as leftovers. In fact, these are voices we are grateful to have been able to amplify, topics we appreciate learning more about, and interviews that we are thankful we have been able to share with you, both then and now. Happy Thanksgiving to you and your loved ones from all of us at State of Belief Radio.
Hi, this is State of Belief producer Ray Kirstein. Combing through the archives, which now date back almost 14 years, we came across two compelling conversations that seem as timely now as they were when we first broadcast them, and arguably are even more important. Throughout the history of this show, we have necessarily focused on attempts to divert the constitutionally apportioned power and resources of our government in the service of narrow, sectarian, theocratic agendas. Again and again, we bemoan the fact that these efforts have never been as effective as they are right now. And yet there is an entire separate initiative which has impacted this country in profound ways, which has set the stage for the rise of the political theocrats, and which is necessarily more difficult to responsibly cover. It's the coordinated long-term effort to leverage the democratic governance of America's mainline Protestant denominations to weaponize them in the ongoing culture wars the political religious right seems to love so much. While today we see the likes of Paula White and Robert Jeffress and Tony Perkins strutting around as the anointed spokespastors of this administration, some of the groundwork was being laid years ago, and in places few would have thought to look for it. For this Thanksgiving Best Of show, we'll rewind to the spring of 2006 and take careful note of the warning being sounded here on State of Belief with Welton and his guests, the Reverend Dr. John Dorhauer, the late Reverend Dr. Andrew Weaver, and the Reverend Dr. Bruce Prescott. But first, a remarkable interview Welton conducted with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. In the summer of 2006, she had just published her second book, titled The Mighty and the Almighty, Reflections on America, God, and World Affairs. In more recent years, Secretary Albright has been outspoken in warning of the global spread of the kinds of fascistic tendencies she first witnessed as a child in Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia. Here is an interview we are grateful to be able to share with you again.
Secretary Albright, thank you so much for joining us on State of Belief.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for asking me.
When you became Secretary of State, did you anticipate the important role that religion would play in dealing with world affairs?
No. On the contrary, I was very surprised. And, you know, one of the first things that was out there on the agenda was what was going on in Northern Ireland. And I thought to myself, why are we dealing with a religious war at the end of the 20th century? And then, of course, it was a theme that became very essential as we looked at the Middle East peace. And I have since come to the real recognition that it's absolutely essential for us to consider the importance of religion and God in world affairs.
What is going on in the Middle East right now? Is this about religion at all, or is it only about politics and power?
I think that a lot of it is about religion, and in some ways an appropriate explanation of religion, and some in a perversion of using God to justify power. But one of the things that became very evident to me, for instance, that if Jerusalem, the issue of Jerusalem and the holy places was just a real estate issue, we would have been able to deal with it a long time ago. But since both the parties believed that that piece of land was given to them by God, it is evident that there is another dimension to it. And it's something that we thought about at Camp David when we even began to talk about a concept called divine sovereignty. If they couldn't agree whether it was Israeli or Palestinian, then it was God's. So it's something that we began to think about. But now, I think, as we are watching what is happening in the Middle East, there's no question that there are religious differences between the Shia and the Sunni that are playing a role, not to speak of the issues between Jews and Muslims and Christians.
So the intra-religious struggles can be every bit as disruptive and even devastating as the inter-religious struggles.
Absolutely, because they depend on the human definitions of what people think that God is telling them to do. And I do think that in the intra-struggle, it is argued among or between the Shia and the Sunni, and even within various aspects of the Sunni faith, that or Sunni division, that in fact there is a different interpretation of what Muhammad wanted. So I think that there really are different interpretations, and obviously they're done by human beings, and therefore they then become interpreted in a way that I think, unfortunately, diverts from what God really wanted.
Secretary Albright, why would an administration that has demonstrated no hesitation about intrusion into religious institutions and the imposition of sectarian convictions on international actions, why would that kind of administration be hesitant to intervene in the Israeli-Hezbollah conflict today?
Well, I think that that's a good question. I think that it is not so much an issue where this administration, which is so sure in terms of how it feels about religion, how that is interpreted in terms of getting involved at this very moment, because the way that this particular fight is taking place now is while God's name is invoked, especially by the Hezbollah, the issue is one now where there is a very straightforward power issue of an attack across a sovereign border. And so I think in many ways it's kind of a difficult example of how religion and power intersect. But I think that at this stage, what the administration is saying and living by is that it is against international law for a group to cross an international boundary and abduct soldiers, and a country such as Israel can defend itself. Article 51 of the UN Charter allows you to defend yourself. So this particular aspect of the fight, I think, is taking place on just pure power politics. And the religious part is something that I think interestingly enough, I don't think being invoked as much as one might think, especially even on the Hezbollah side.
I take it that you have the sense that the Secretary of State perhaps should already have been in the region.
Well, I believe in diplomacy, and I actually do not think that in the long run this issue can be solved militarily. Given what I've said about an invasion and all those things, which I think are a statement of fact, ultimately there has to be a political solution to this. And so I do think diplomacy is important. One of the problems that exists, if I might say it this way, is when we were in office, we had a constant dialogue going in the Middle East. We had a Middle East peace team that spent time in the region. I was prepared to go at any time, and I also met with various of the requisite leaders in some European capital. And then, of course, President Clinton was involved very deeply. At this stage, there is not that kind of a layered possibility because this administration has not had that same kind of a Middle East peace team. So if one had one druthers, the best thing would be is if there were lower-level people in the region trying to sort out what's going on. We don't have that. And so I think at this stage the secretary needs to get personally involved and needs to get to the region in a way that allows her to begin to meet with the Saudis and the Jordanians and the Egyptians, for starters, members of the Arab League, and then work also with other Europeans that have gone in there already, Prime Minister de Villepin from France. Or I gather that today she's being briefed by the Secretary General, who has himself been briefed about the UN team. So I am presuming that there are things going on behind the scenes. But ultimately, I think that the United States needs to get very actively involved in this.
Well, let me just step back to that layered approach that you were talking about. This administration has operated somewhat with an apocalyptic vision on so many different subjects. Why has there been such distance from the Middle East for the first 5 years of the administration?
I can't answer that question except to make maybe a little bit of a flip comment, which is because we did it. There has definitely been an approach in this administration that anything that we did, they would not do. In fact, they talk about ABC, anything but Clinton. And they it's true with North Korea. It's true with a whole host of issues in Africa, Latin America, and the most true in the Middle East. And I think that it's very unfortunate because we know that when the United States has been involved, there has been a process. Fewer people have died. Just for numbers, in the last 4.5 years, somewhere between 3.5 and 4 times as many Israelis and Palestinians have died as died during the time that we were in our peace process. So I think it's a mistake. And I do believe that we do better when we are involved, but you'd have to ask them why they aren't doing it. I mean, my estimation of it is that they thought that President Clinton and I and Dennis Ross were overly involved, but I don't think you can be overly involved in trying to make sure that people are not dying.
If you get a flip comment, I get a flip comment, and it looks to me like that strategy wouldn't apply to peacemaking. But perhaps it does.
Well, I hope one would think it wouldn't. But, you know, one of the things that I had said for a long time, what they would have been really smart to do would have been to name President Clinton to be the negotiator. We came so close, you know.
Yes.
And I still believe that the parameters that President Clinton laid down in December 2000 could ultimately be the solution. So I think he would have been tremendous to do this. And if he'd succeeded, then everybody would have, you know, applauded and found the fruits of peace. And if he'd failed, they would have blamed him. But I just think that it was something that would have been a good idea instead of just kind of saying, you know, we're not doing this kind of work.
Madam Secretary, you have called President Bush's foreign policy, quote, theologically presumptuous, and written, I think the U.S. government has thoroughly botched its response to international terror, damaged America's reputation, and substituted slogans for strategy in promoting freedom. Why do you say that?
Well, because I think that there has been an approach that has divided the world into good and evil. And the truth is, it doesn't work that way. There are certainly various evil aspects, but who are we to decide? You know, we know what evil is, but we're not fully clear always about what good is. Even Jesus Christ said, who am I that is all good? I just think that we have to be very careful in making such absolute statements and putting ourselves always as if we knew everything about what is good. And I preferred very much the way that President Clinton talked about this, whom I interviewed for my book, who said that while we are on in this world, we do not know fully what is all good, what is all truth. And he then quoted the Apostle Paul in Corinthians, who says, "I now see through a glass darkly, and then it will be revealed," which means I don't know everything right now. And what has troubled me about the Bush administration, and I don't in any way have any criticism of the fact that President Bush is a very religious person. I worked for two very religious presidents. I think it's just a question of how that gets translated into policy. And when you are so sure that we are on God's side, rather than the way Abraham Lincoln said it, which is that God is on our side, then you find yourself in a position where you have narrowed the choices and made it more difficult for people, other countries, to support us. And that's what's troubled me about the approach, that we've made it much harder for people to support us because we are asking them to support just the extension of American power on an ideological basis.
Madam Secretary, is it your perception that there is a world perception that the United States is a Christian nation eager to minimize the influence of Islam?
Well, I think that, I don't know if I'd put it that way, or I think that what there is a perception, and a lot of the polling that's out there, and I've been involved with the Pew Attitude Surveys, is that the United States does not take other countries' national interest into any consideration at all in creating our own national interest. In other words, that we have our own agenda and we don't see it as anything that we need to listen to other countries. I do think we are perceived as a Christian nation, but I think it's more a matter of us being perceived as acting as if we have the whole truth and we want things done our way, not just on the basis of religion, but on the basis of how we exert our power. And for me, one of the truly saddest things is how democracy is now perceived, which is something that is imposed by an occupation army rather than something that is supported from a grassroots effort by supporting the groups within countries that actually want to make decisions about how they run their, you know, how the people get involved in their political system.
So you personally, the way you see it, do you see evidences of conflict between Christianity and Islam in our foreign policy?
Well, we know, I mean, in many ways, just to be fair here, is I think President Bush has been pretty careful about the way he's talked about Islam. I think at the very earliest stages, I mean, there were slips of the tongue about crusades and things like that, but on the whole, I think President Bush has been respectful of Islam. I think that there have been those who have carried, not in the administration particularly, although some military people did this, is to characterize all Islam, all members of the Muslim faith as somehow being involved in terrorism and doing a kind of a characterization on the basis of the extremists. But I think that President Bush has been pretty careful about this.
You've said that our nation can't defeat al-Qaeda without an effective political strategy. What are the basic ingredients of that strategy?
Well, I think that the strategy has to be is we need to know much more about what creates groups like al-Qaeda. Now, we know specifically that Osama bin Laden was opposed to secularization and westernization in Saudi Arabia and the presence of American troops. But then the kinds of people that adhere to al-Qaeda in different places are some who are feel the lack of dignity, the lack of jobs, the lack of a sense that Islam is respected. So there are whole, it's not, there's not one simple answer. I think that we do need to kill terrorists. I mean, I have nothing I think those people that want to kill us, who are like Osama bin Laden, who are bound and determined to use suicide bombers and military force, I think it's our responsibility, or I felt when I was a policymaker, we can't deal with that. But I do think that we need to understand much larger environment that creates people who feel so displaced that they begin to hate America and blame us for everything. So I think there are any number of layers to how you deal with terrorists.
Secretary Albright, you describe yourself in your very insightful book as an optimist who worries a lot. I wonder, in the midst of these critical days, what's winning right now, hope or more worry?
No, I mean, kind of a combination of both. I see this time as a crossroads, and potentially, and this is really, trying to find a silver lining in this, is that sometimes in the Middle East specifically, when things get truly bad and people face kind of an abyss, there is room for diplomatic action that will show people that really provide some kind of a path to getting out of this, because it looks, you face the depth and you think we can't go this direction, which is exactly why I think the United States needs to be there to try to present some proposals and to work with some of the leaders in the area. Or if nothing is done and there can be kind of just an evolution of the fighting, then I worry that this is going to spread into a greater regional conflict. But since I am an optimist, and if I were in any position of power, I would be worrying, but I would be doing something to make sure that at this crossroads we take the path that leads out of it.
Secretary Albright, two questions that I ask each of my guests, and you can answer as succinctly or as extensively as you wish. One simple question: how do you define religious liberty?
I define religious liberty as right to be able to follow your belief in God in whatever way that you want to, and that you have the capability of creating your own relationship with God. And if you think that it's through an organized church, that's the way it should be. If you want to do it individually, that's the way it should be. But nobody should tell you what you can believe. And so for me, religious liberty is the capability of making up your own mind within a system about how you relate to God.
Second question is, in your opinion, what's the proper role of faith or religion in a person's public life?
I think that it is very appropriate for people to believe what they want, and it goes with my previous answer. And I think that most of the leaders that I have met are people of faith, and it is something that is very personal to them. For most of the leaders that I know, including myself, it is a source of strength. I think it's inappropriate when one's personal faith becomes policy. And I think that if you look at the thing that I found in writing my book is that every American president in some form or another have invoked God. But there's a difference if you feel that you are inspired by your faith versus when you decide, like President McKinley, for instance, that it's our duty to Christianize the Philippines, or when President Bush says, God wants me to be president, and then has policies that really reflect exactly what he believes, the veto of the stem cell research.
Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, you have honored us by coming on State of Belief. You have given us insights We are deeply grateful. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for your excellent questions. I appreciate the interview very, very much. A very, very thoughtful interview. Thank you. Anytime.
Coming up, more highlights from past shows that we're thankful for. If you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to the best of State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. You're hearing highlights from some of our favorite past shows.
The following panel discussion was first aired in May of 2006.
Most listeners to State of Belief are well aware of the religious rights efforts to take over the mechanisms of our government. Maybe you're not aware of the religious rights efforts to take over churches and even whole denominations. Indeed, there is a conclusion today that mainline Christian denominations are under siege. From deep within the Christian right have come movements aimed at dismantling and neutralizing denominations like the United Methodist Church, the United Church of Christ, Presbyterian Church USA, and on the list goes. I have with me in the studio today three people who know this conclusion experientially. Dr. Andrew J. Weaver is a United Methodist pastor and a clinical psychologist living in New York City. He is the associate publisher of Zion's Herald, an independent religious journal published by the Boston Wesleyan Association. He's researched and written on the right-wing attack on mainline churches. Dr. Bruce Prescott, executive director of Mainstream Oklahoma Baptist, president of the Oklahoma Chapter of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. The Reverend Dr. John Dorhauer is a minister for the St. Louis Association of the United Church of Christ. Thanks to you three for being with us on State of Belief.
Glad to be here.
Glad to be here.
I'm curious as to how you became aware of what's happening in mainline denominations with the Christian right. Did you come to this conclusion ideologically or experientially? Did you see it up close? How'd it go?
Well, this is John Dorhauer. I experienced it firsthand long before I was able to extrapolate what was happening on a wider basis. As a local church pastor for 16 years, I was aware of churches in the surrounding area who were experiencing extreme levels of conflict over what became known as the wedge issues of the day. 20 years ago, it was the ordination of women. Few years after that, it was abortion, and now it's homosexuality. And I discovered over time that churches within the United Church of Christ were willing to disaffiliate over these issues. It took me a while to sort of lose that narrow perspective of experiencing that in the local church and discover that the same phenomena was happening on a much wider basis, not just across the United Church of Christ, but across mainline Protestant Christianity. And it was, for me, the work of Andrew Weaver that first helped me to make those connections.
Dr. Weaver, how did you come to a conclusion about it?
Well, I began to do research after I read a book, United Methodists at Risk, which was published by a prominent bishop in the United Methodist Church, Dale White, and others. And I looked at the research, extremely concerned that basically they were saying that outside money from Richard Mellon Scaife and political operatives like Adolf Coors were funneling money into an attack on churches. There, as far as I know, I've asked several historians, this has no precedent in American church history. So I began to systematically read. At that time, I had a research department with a couple of PhDs and a couple of research assistants. I got all the material and read for 6 months and became absolutely convinced this was the case. And after that, I felt called to speak out like Paul Revere and ring the bell of alarm. There is no doubt whatsoever Weldon, that this is a systematic effort to undermine mainline churches who still have transparent democratic processes in them that become the culture war, an area for the culture wars.
Dr. Prescott, I know that you know this experientially. Talk a little bit about your reflections on having gone through the experience of the Southern Baptist Convention's takeover.
Yes, I do have experience of the Southern Baptist Convention being taken over by right-wing fundamentalist group. It was an organized attempt. There wasn't any secret about it. And there's been a conflict within the Southern Baptist Convention, kind of a struggle for the churches, individual churches. Here in Oklahoma, I work with the moderate Baptists in this state, and we feel like that there are churches here that have been targeted to be taken over by fundamentalists that are affiliated with the Southern Baptist Convention. So we watch that carefully and closely and try to help people to devise strategies to overcome that.
Well, let me ask all three of you. Are we talking about this takeover movement of Christian denominations? Is this a religious movement or is this a political movement?
By and large, this is that there is not a grassroots movement to do this. The money overwhelmingly, and it is follow the money, comes from people outside these communions.
What's the motivation? What do they want to do?
It is fundamentally a political motivation. Just as the right wing is trying to affect the court system, the educational system, these churches were the primary bulwark against many of the right wing causes under Reagan. And they decided after that, when they saw United Methodists, United Church of Christ, and the others being effective, they became the targets.
Dr. Dorhauer, is that the way you see it?
Absolutely. I do want to say that although that Andrew's right about the money coming from politically motivated individuals, the truth is about those experiencing this in the local church, many of them are unaware of that political motivation and that political connection. They're being fed material from outside sources, but they don't know where that material's coming from, and that material fuels the fire in the local church. So it's hard for an individual inside the churches that I'm dealing with to look up and see the IRD as the source of their anger and conflict.
What's the IRD?
The IRD is the Institute on Religion and Democracy that is funded by the Mellon Scaifes of the world and the Adolf Coors of the world. But the other thing that I want to point out is that in those local churches where those fires are being fueled by this material, the pastors all of a sudden find themselves unwilling to speak about issues that they know are going to raise this level of conflict. And so what the politically motivated achieve is the silence of the religious conscious voice that has historically led this country and that has challenged some of the more strident political voices that have gone out over the edge. And those voices are being silenced today because of this.
You could easily call the Institute on Religion and Democracy the Institute of Sex and More Sex, because if you Google homosexuality on their site, an incredible percentage of everything they do is a gay-bashing attack that works, and it is really is fear-mongering, to the point that the Ku Klux Klan last summer endorsed and encouraged on their site one of the attacks that the Institute on Religion and Democracy made against United Methodist group with over a dozen bishops attended in celebration of gay and lesbian Christians. So their target is really fear-mongering that turned, in this case, to the Ku Klux Klan endorsing them. That's the level of vitriol that is involved in these groups.
So what do they get if they take over the denomination? What is it they want? The money? What is it?
I think ultimately what they want is the silence. But along the way, at least in the United Church of Christ, what they're getting is pieces of property worth millions of dollars,
absolutely,
membership contributions in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, endowments in the millions of dollars. In the United Church of Christ, any local congregation can disaffiliate anytime they want. So their target in the United Church of Christ are individual congregations.
Right.
Dr. Prescott, how do you see that?
Well, you know, what I think is happening is that they're keeping the mainline congregations in turmoil with wedge issues.
Yep.
And then that allows people that have a secular political agenda to accomplish whatever it is that they're trying to do. I think when you talk about the Institute of Religion and Democracy, you're talking about Catholic neoconservatives mm-hmm. who've got some of the same ultimate political goals as neoconservatives in the religious right, and not even religious right, they just the right. And they're accomplishing those objectives by keeping the mainline congregations' voices silent.
I want to know who the key players are in this whole movement to take over Christian denominations. And I wish one of you would talk about the Institute for Religion and Democracy. I want to know more about that one in particular.
Well, the Institute of Religion and Democracy began out of the first Reagan White House as an attack really on liberation theology in Central America. It has morphed over time as a direct attack on mainline churches. The key players, and one of the most disturbing part of this, are neoconservative Roman Catholics. Six of them sit on the board. That is 35% of the board members. There is not 1 cent, Weldon, spent on any change in the Roman Catholic Church. This, I consider, and others, the most significant breach in ecumenical goodwill since Vatican II. Most all of us, my great teacher Albert Outler was a respondent to Vatican II in the Methodist Church, greatly shaped by those experiences. But these people, these Roman Catholics, are the power center of this that get the money from SCAFE and the other neocon sources. The people and the other people involved in this are very minor players. So the Institute on Religion and Democracy is funded by secular money as a propaganda machine, really against these churches, and the leadership has also Roman Catholics, which is something that the Roman Catholic, responsible Roman Catholics, need to address.
Dr. Dorhauer, how a movement that started in response to liberation theology in South America is concerned about a church in Norman, Oklahoma? I don't understand that.
Well, let me see if I can't make some connections here. I also want to mention one of the board members, Mark Tooley, is a former operative from the Central Intelligence Agency. So when it comes to writing propaganda, which is getting passed out in our churches, he knows well how to do that. I was shocked when you talk about their presence in local churches. We flew Andrew Weaver in last year into St. Louis to do a training event for our clergy and for our lay people. The only advertising we did for this was through our email network to our local clergy and to their churches. The IRD sent a mole to that event in St. Louis to tape Andrew Weaver and then to write about that event on their website. I was shocked that they would be interested in an event like that, but they knew about it, and they had somebody there. The connections to the local church are through their Association for Church Renewal. This is now a group of over 30 renewal movements within each of the separate denominations. There are currently two functioning within the United Church of Christ. One has been around for a long time, the Biblical Witness Fellowship, the president of which is David Runyon Bareford, who is intimately aligned with the Institute on Religion and Democracy and has been for a long time. If they have a national event, he's one of their featured speakers. If they publish a letter that goes out to the press or to the public, he's one of the consistent signatories on those letters. The second group, the renewal group within this Association for Church Renewal, headed by the Institute on Religion and Democracy, is the Faithful and Welcoming Group, who formed for the first time in January of this year. These renewal movements are an overt attempt to take over the denomination. Much has happened with the Southern Baptists. That's probably where they've been the most effective.
Dr. Prescott, let's use that as a segue to go to you. Who who was involved in taking over the Southern Baptist Convention? Was it the Institute for Religion and Democracy, or were there individuals or organizations? Would you point a finger at some people?
Okay, I don't believe that the Institute of Religion and Democracy was involved in the takeover of the Southern Baptist Convention. I think it's a spinoff of tactics that were used in the Southern Baptist Convention and applied to other mainline denominations. I think that probably the deep roots for the takeover of the Southern Baptist Convention come from Ed McAteer and the Religious Roundtable and Tim LaHaye's Council for National Policy. And I think those are the organizations that brought people like Richard Mellon Scaife and Howard Amundson and Joseph Coors and a whole crew of other wealthy kind of affluent industrialists that had a lot of money to fund these kinds of things with people that had religious concerns. And they were exceedingly conservative. They formed an alliance. And they've been very effective in pushing their agenda.
How do you get this done? What is the strategy for taking over a denomination?
Well, you undermine confidence in the leadership. You constantly create a picture that they are doing untoward things. They are extremists. And so you use, as John has said, propaganda language continually, and drive home wedge issues. Human sexuality is the primary one because there is so much emotion around that question. But they are also jingoistic, patriotistic things. Recently, United Methodist bishops, two out of three of them, signed a very strong statement in November against this war as unjust and immoral. Also said the occupation, which is important, is unjust and immoral. Well, when Fox News called Rove at the White House, they had no comment. But within 10 days, the Institute on Religion and Democracy did a smear piece in the Weekly Standard where Fred Barnes is on the board of the Institute of Religion and Democracy, who is on Fox News and on the Weekly Standard board, in which they said they also did a fund letter at Christmas time, December the 22nd, saying that the bishops would not have defended America at Normandy. It's something that, you know, Herr Goebbels would have been had his heart warmed over the kind of comments they made. So we're talking about extreme propaganda to try to divide people.
And so when you get confidence in the leaders shaken, what's next?
Well, what happens, and I want to talk about that, the shaking of the confidence in the leadership in the United Church of Christ again in particular. We go into churches where we discover material has been handed out, and the material will read something like, the United Church of Christ does not believe in Scripture. The United Church of Christ does not believe in the Lordship of Jesus. The Faithful and Welcoming Group, which I mentioned a minute ago, handed out at Eden Seminary in St. Louis on March 16th a brochure at their presentation that said that the General Synod delegates last July declared their independence from the teachings of Jesus and the authority of Scripture. Now, this is the literature that they're handing out in churches across our denomination. It doesn't play everywhere, but the point is that in some places it will play, and they're looking for the people who will receive that information and then will receive a follow-up call. And those churches are being targeted by trained activists who are going in and within a year or two serving on councils and boards and asking the councils to pass resolutions like, if in our next pastoral search we don't find a UCC pastor whom we think is fitting, then we're going to amend our bylaws, which require us to call a UCC pastor, and we can call anybody we want. At the same time, the Biblical Witness Fellowship, one of the renewal groups attached to the ACR, the Association for Church Renewal, has organized what they call the Godly Pastor Network. And they send recruits out to evangelical seminaries across the country, pastors who have no relationship with the United Church of Christ, and they build a network and contact those churches in which those activists have appeared and tell them, here are pastors willing to serve your church.
So in the minds of these people, there must be an ungodly pastor network, too.
That's the implication.
Bruce Prescott, does this all sound familiar?
Oh, it does. The only difference is it's just incredible that it's people that are outside the denomination.
Yeah.
Ours, we had our own group of fundamentalists that organized themselves and did these kinds of things within the denomination. But it wasn't really people from outside, I think, doing it.
Some of you have written, or maybe all of you have written, about the hookup between this takeover movement and Christian Reconstructionism and the Dominionist movement related to that. My guess is that a lot of listeners to State of Belief are not familiar with those terms and those organizations. Give us a very quick introduction to them.
Well, since the name Howard Amundson is the core of this. He's a billionaire whose wife sits on the Institute of Religion and Democracy board. They are big contributors.
To
Christian Reconstructionism. They were, Howard Amundson for 23 years was on the board, the Chalcedon Institute board. He is the primary funder. They believe that we should not have a democracy, but we need to have a twisted sense of Calvinist theocracy in which, of other things, people like everyone on this radio show should be stoned to death because we don't share their religious beliefs out of literalism, out of Deuteronomy. Gay should be stoned to death and incorrigible children. And you would think Bill Moyers has talked about this. If this was a group of lunatic fringe, these people have infiltrated into a system where they're contributing to money to take over mainline churches.
What about Dominionism? Is that what it sounds like it's about?
It's exactly what it sounds like it's about. It's a fundamental belief that the principles literally interpreted of Scripture ought to be the basis of our governance. And as Andrew said, those who do not believe the literal fundamental interpretation of that Scripture are to be eliminated.
So they're going to impose those through religious institutions or through legislation and officers of the government?
Their goal is to take over the government.
Take over the democracy.
Right. 30 years ago, this movement began by getting local members elected to school boards, to city councils, to county councils. And what we're seeing now is the byproduct of that is school boards are debating whether or not they can teach creationism or evolution.
So there's a close connection with the Christian Coalition.
I think there's been a close connection with the Christian Coalition, but I actually think that in the Southern Baptist Convention, there is very strong infiltration or maybe just a movement toward Christian Reconstructionism. Let me give you some examples.
What does that mean? Say that. Talk about that.
Well, Christian Reconstructionism is a blueprint for civil society. They want to make the Ten Commandments the law of the land. That's why Roy's Rock is so important. They want to strengthen patriarchically ordered families. They want to close the public schools and make parents totally responsible for the education of their children. They want to require tithes to ecclesiastical agencies to provide welfare services. And that would reduce the role of government to the defense of the nation.
Yep.
And the defense of property rights. Please. Their goals have just about been accomplished over the last, five, 6 years, and sometimes before that. These goals are the goals of the religious right. What distinguishes Reconstructionism from Dominionism is there is a full philosophy for Christian Reconstructionism, and not everybody will follow that. Not even everybody that identifies with these goals knows about Reconstructionism. But the idea that Christians should dominate society is prevalent throughout the religious right. And this Dominionist idea, I think, is being worked out right now by our current administration.
So there is a partisan political component to this movement.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's Republican.
I think that one of two things are going on at the same time. I think that there are those with political aspirations who have no real theological bent whatsoever, who benefit from the kind of paranoia that is fed by those from the religious right, and I think they use them to their advantage. I think that those at the core of this Dominionist and Christian Reconstructionist movement also use those on the political right to their advantage.
Now, Dr. Doher, I know that you have a website where you write about this, because one of my concerns, and it grows out of my experience in the Southern Baptist Convention, is that lay people, just good-hearted people that want a good denomination and a good nation, don't know what's going on. And
right.
They knew better, they would act.
I think that's absolutely right.
Absolutely.
I write weekly for a website called Talk to Action. And what I write about is how the local church experiences this phenomenon. Again, many of the members in the local church have no idea who the IRD is, have no idea about Reconstructionist theology and Dominionism. They're just good people, and they hear people whom they respect and trust telling them that because of the United Church of Christ's position on marriage equality, it is now an evil institution. We have the tape of a pastor preaching a sermon in one of our UCC churches in which he says that the United Church of Christ is like dog crap cooked into a brownie, that just a little bit of it ruins the whole thing. Now, his mindset is that the United Church of Christ must go. I don't believe there was anybody in that church who felt that way prior to his preaching that sermon. But once he preached it and moved them down that road, they immediately felt that they must disassociate themselves from this evil institution known as the United Church of Christ.
Dr. Doerhauer, we know the United Church of Christ is in the crosshairs. What other denominations are in the crosshairs?
Half of all of the money the Institute of Religion and Democracy spends is attack on the United Methodist Church, and has been for years. It is the big battleship. And if you take out the 45 million people that are represented by the National Council of Churches, you're going to hollow out the core of one of the cores of this democracy. And so there's an attack on all of them, the Presbyterians, the Episcopalians, United Church of Christ. Sure. And when Reverend Thomas spoke up recently, the head of the United Church of Christ, it was a full-blast smear of him. And this is what people are intimidated. But the United Methodist bishops must have the courage to stand up and take this on, because our church is in peril of being split and certainly being muted in terms of its conscience.
My experience in Southern Baptist life was that people who talk like the three of you talk are called troublemakers. You're the real troublemaker.
Those are nice words.
At my last church, I was identified as the Antichrist from the pulpit of the First Baptist Church in the town I last served.
The other problem is that there are many people in pastorates in these congregations who say, you're making too much of this. It's a big deal. It's only a tempest in a teapot. It will go away. The Southern Baptist Convention was lost not because of those trying to take it over, but because of people arguing that it wasn't a big deal.
Absolutely.
And people came in.
Yeah, naivete is this core of this. All these traditions have niceness at the core and are taught to be nice. They're playing. While we've been thinking it's touch football, they've been playing tackle.
Dr. Weaver, Dr. Prescott, Dr. Doerhauer, thank you so much for joining us on State of Belief today. And State of Belief listeners, this is serious stuff. We're talking about a sea change in American religion as well as a sea change in American politics. We've got to be listening, and we've got to be acting.
The Reverend Dr. Bruce Prescott disaffiliated with the Baptist denomination at Thanksgiving in 2013, but continued to serve as a leader in progressive Christian movements. The Reverend Dr. Andrew Weaver passed away 2 years after this interview was recorded, in 2008. And the Reverend Dr. John Doerhauer currently serves as the 9th General Minister and President of the United Church of Christ. You can listen to this conversation again and share it with friends who you think would benefit from hearing it on our website, www.stateofbelief.com.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say thank you, thank you. Your generous support of this program is vital to keeping us on the air. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, and you think it's important that others hear it as well, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And do you know someone who you think might benefit from hearing what you're hearing? Please commit to sharing State of Belief with just one person this week. Do it on social media or in person. It is incredibly helpful to know that we are reaching more and more people, especially at a time such as this. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be a part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.